This month's speaker is Anita Arakawa, who is a certified vision rehabilitation and low vision therapist with the Veterans Administration Medical Center in West Los Angeles. As a visually impaired person herself and as a therapist since 1993, she understands firsthand the challenges of living day to day with low vision, and she shared some of her techniques with us. This was recorded at the 1999 Visions Conference of the Foundation Fighting Blindness, but the things she has to say still hold very true to us today.
Thank you very much. The primary role of the rehab teacher is to provide education, provide resources, provide encouragement, provide options, so that the individual with vision impairment can make some good informed choices, can look at their life. And if the instructor has worth anything, they've taught the individual how to strategize and problem solve. Because unfortunately, I'm visually impaired also, I don't always have a rehab teacher at my disposal or a mobility instructor at my disposal when something new comes along. And so all of us are in a position where we have to look at the task and find ways to adapt it or modify it so that we can do what we need to do safely, reliably, and with some measure of dignity as a result of, you know, vision loss. Any one of these subject areas, which includes cooking, dressing, grooming, identification of labeling and organizing, each one of these things could take a week. So what I want to do is briefly go through some of these areas, and I'll leave some time at the end so you can ask any specific questions that you might have. First of all, some of the things we need to look at when you have a task that you're trying to do is try to find out first what the task is, what are the variables, which include what type of vision do you have? Is your vision consistent? Does it fluctuate? Do you need vision to do this task? What type of lighting is involved? Is this task something you're going to be doing in an environment that's consistent, or you have to do this task in other environments such as money? You know, at home, with good lighting, you know, you could probably identify your bills. But if you go to a restaurant where the lighting is what they call mood lighting, and you can't see your dollar bills, that's a task that you have to be able to manage with good lighting or bad. So that's what I mean by looking at the environment and seeing if that environment changes depending on what the task is. Do you live alone? If you live alone, it makes a big difference in terms of how you're going to organize things. If you live with somebody else, you're not going to be able to put the ketchup bottle next to the mustard bottle on the second shelf in the refrigerator and know it's going to be there unless you're really, really good at training your family. So you have to look at those variables too. Are things going to move on you? And if that's the case, then you have to develop a strategy of labeling. So given all of those variables in terms of consistency of your vision, what the task is, where the environmental changes, all of these things have to be looked at when you're making a decision to label or organize things in your home or in your office or wherever. The majority of you who have vision impairment are legally blind, and of course lighting is critical for you. Too much lighting is terrible, and too little lighting is not enough. So lighting is a big factor for you. And if you're in a familiar area, and I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, you know, you can get around pretty well because you can, you know, can scan, you can find things, and you're doing just fine. But as soon as you go into an unfamiliar area or an area where you have to do a lot of looking, then you're in trouble, and you're not as efficient with your vision as you could be. The other area to look at is on your worst eye day, can you still perform that task? Because you want to be able to perform whatever that task is on a good day or bad day. And if it's a bad day and you can't perform that task, then you need to come up with a different system or have a sighted spouse. The idea is to allow you to be as independent as possible. So let's start off with labeling. And again, I'm probably going to talk about some things that you're already familiar with, but if you're not, you should be. These labeling things could include high marks, high dots, yarn, colored tape. Those are some of the non-visual tactile markings. The high marks are something that comes in a tube, like an epoxy. And you, a lot of ovens, you can label a lot of things with this, and once it dries, it leaves a very hard tactile marking. It takes about a good 6 to 8 hours to dry, and it's a bright orange fluorescent, and it's really good for permanent markings. The high dots have an adhesive back, and they're great for marking things like the microwave, sometimes the oven dial, VCRs, stereos, whatever you can find that needs some sort of raised marking, like a thermostat. For people who are partially sighted, you're looking a lot at high contrast, and we use heavy markers, Avery labels, which you can mark onto. Again, we use different color tapes, because sometimes color discrimination is still available for most of us. So some of these things are tools of the trade, and all of you should have them. Everything from rubber bands to tacks to whatever you can think of to give you some sort of cue when you're labeling something. We're also looking at placement. For example, if you are at home and you put your favorite coffee cup next to the canister, you can pretty much know that canister is not going to move. So you pretty much know when you go back to the canister, you're going to find your coffee cup. However, if you just place that coffee cup on the table next to a plate, it's very likely that plate's going to move, and then you won't know where your coffee cup is. So it's really important that when you place things, you place it next to something that's stationary and it's not going to move. For example, like your keys. How many of you come home, put your keys down, and walk off and do your next project? Then how many of you are looking for the keys later on? So the idea of placement is being consistent and finding a place to put it that's permanent. So you're not spending a lot of time looking. In addition to placement, we're looking at if we're going to look to organize your kitchen cupboards. Okay. There are an array of spices, an array of canned goods. One way of labeling things is using the alphabet system. Again, it's a system that's not going to change. So, for example, on the first shelf, in the first row would be, corn. Next to the corn would be the, first would be carrots, then corn, then peas. But you get the gist in a way that it's systematic, and it basically slows down, again, the time you're spending on looking for something. So in addition to labeling, so you can identify it tactically, putting it in a place that's consistent and a place that's organized. Baskets are really helpful when you're putting in the bathroom or in the bedroom or even in the living room where you put your mail. Because it's a place, it's a container that's contained, and again, it's a home for whatever object you're looking for. The big thing with labeling and organizing is making sure that the markings that you're putting on there is something you can see on your worst eye day, and put in a place that is consistent. So again, you have more consistently, and it really cuts down the search time for things. I touched briefly on lighting. Well, I'm sure all of you, if you don't know, recognize that lighting is really critical. It can devastate your vision you have left, or it can help to enhance it, or it can just not be worthwhile at all. Most people have little or no vision at night. They do fine at dusk. They do terrible on bright days. And again, depending on the acuity and depending on the pathology, they determine how light affects the individual. What's really important with lighting is to make sure that your dominant eye, whatever the good eye is, we find ways to maximize that or enhance it. And we suggest that a person put a gooseneck lamp on the side of their good eye. Now, you're going to have to experiment with the wattage. What we have found is that full spectrum lighting has been the most popular in our clinic. But again, that's the majority, but not all. Some do very well with incandescent, anywhere from a 60 to a 75-watt bulb. But if you're using a gooseneck lamp, it basically cones the light directly where you need it to be. A 150-watt bulb in the ceiling is only going to light the ceiling. It's not going to give you the direct lighting that you need for any type of near-task activity. So lighting is very, very important. There's ways to put lighting under your kitchen cabinets, in your closets, and it's going to be something that you're going to want to investigate if you haven't already to make your life a little bit more functional at home. So some of the things I want to talk to you about in terms of things in the kitchen, which in the cooking capacity. There's so much, I mean, there's really so much to talk about when it comes to this area, especially in the area of cooking. Measuring food, measuring when following a recipe. Some examples of different ways to label your measuring cups. Now, of course, we all know there's the nesting cups. Then those are for dry ingredients. And then, of course, the measuring cups for the wet ingredients. What I like with the nesting cups is that you use the 1 cup, the half cup, the 1/3 cup, and the 1/4 cup. And you get rid of the 3/4 cup and the 2/3 cup. It just makes life a lot simpler. It's easier to label them. Bought a large print Dymo labeler, which for those of us who aren't going to learn Braille, it's tactile, but it's also high contrast. And you can label just about anything under the sun with that. I've got a friend who's got about 800 collection of CDs, and he labels all of his CDs with a large print labeler. Now, he's not able to see this anymore, but he can feel it. He can feel it with his fingers, and he can read the writing on all those CDs. But that is one way of labeling your measuring cups. Or you can use the high dots. So for the 1/3 cup, we would put 3 high dots on it. For the 1/2 cup, you put 2 dots. For the 1/4 cup, you put 4 dots. Now, if you're a cook, most people who cook don't necessarily even look at those anyway. They can just tell by feeling it. But they nest inside of each other. And with the measuring cup for pouring liquids, we use the high marks to label, leaving a tactile marking on the different measurements. The 1/2 cup, the 1 cup, depending on, you know, how it's set up. The 1 cup measure, we put a line on the 1/4 cup and the 1/2 cup, both inside and outside of the cup, so that when you're pouring, you can feel inside and you can feel with the marking and feel where to stop pouring. The same with the measuring spoons. Most measuring spoons are the tablespoon, teaspoon, 1/2 teaspoon, 1/4 teaspoon. And again, keep it on the ring. It's really not necessary to label those things. You can just tell by the way their size and how they fit inside of each other. Probably one of the most important things in the kitchen for cooking, I would include the measuring cup and a timer and a wooden spoon. Now the measuring cup, you ask why that? Well, because when you're cooking something, now this is one of the biggest areas I have questions on. How do I tell when something's done? Well, depending on what you're doing, for example, if I'm going to be frying chicken, I'm frying chicken thighs, what I want to make sure is all the chicken thighs are the same size, and that I have a timer so that I'm timing each side I cook it on. So maybe the first time I cook chicken thighs since I lost my vision, I would have someone with me, and I would know that on medium heat with a gas stove, medium to low, I would cook on one side for 2 minutes, flip it over, cook another side for 2 minutes, then the other side for 4 minutes, the other side for 4 minutes, then I'm done. That is a way, by timing it, and with the consistency of portion size, then you know that you'll know the item is done. Same thing with a hamburger or a fish. If you time it out, and everything's the same size, and when you're baking cookies, all of you know that when you bake cookies, if you have one huge cookie and one little cookie, that one cookie will be scorched and one won't be done. So again, it's very, very important that you have consistency in the portion size, have the timing, have a timer, and you have even heat. Pouring, transferring. There are different ways of pouring. I think all of you have probably seen the liquid level indicator. And this is a device that sits over a cup. There's a battery on one side and 2 metal prongs, and the metal prongs sit inside the cup. And the battery sits on the outside of the cup. And as you pour the liquid into the cup, once it hits the 2 metal prongs, it makes this beeping noise. But there are other ways of pouring as well. Now, all of you who have some vision, you can probably tell that when you have a white cup and black coffee, you can see the good contrast. For those who don't, it's possible to stick your finger, your index finger, inside, just inside the cup, and as you feel the cup, as you're feeling the heat, Now, you have to practice at this. You can get really, really good at this. As you feel the heat rising, you'll know when to stop before it hits your finger. Test by sound also. How many of you have paid attention to how a glass sounds when you're filling it up? As it gets closer to the top, it makes a higher pitch sound. Now, again, all of this takes practice. And you'll know you're doing good when you go to a Chinese restaurant and you can fill up a teacup. That is probably the biggest challenge. And when you can do that, you have mastered pouring. Because all of you know that there are teeny weeny cups, very, very hot, and you don't want to mess. So the challenge is going to be is to practice making sure that you have the spout touching the cup and then lifting it up ever so slightly. Now, all of you probably know, those of us who have vision that's different in one eye than the other, that you're going to have areas of problems with depth perception. How many of you have missed the cup when pouring? How many of you have poured something into a saucepan and missed the pan? Or how many of you have reached out for something and it was further or closer than you thought? So a lot of these things, because you have the vision, you can see it, you may not necessarily have good depth perception. And so even though you have pretty good central acuity, it's going to be really important to implement some of these non-visual steps so that you can use your vision for what it's good for. Because if you're partially sighted, there are some things you can see well and some things you can't. I mean, how many of you have sailed through the house when the phone rang, forgetting you can't see, and fell into the coffee table? Because you just basically are reacting versus seeing. So this is another example of using your vision as efficiently as possible. And that's the key. Use your vision for what it's good for. And if you notice deficits in that, you develop some non-visual strategies to make up for it. In the area of pouring, a real simple test or task is whenever you're trying to pour something into a saucepan, this is where a wooden spoon comes into place. How many of you, when you've made oatmeal, you sort of poured the oats in off the side of the pan, or you're adding milk into something or adding something in, and you pour it into the pan and it sort of dribbles down the side? One way to eliminate that is if you take a wooden spoon or the spoon you're stirring with and put it in the center of the pot, and then you pour down the spoon. That way it's going to eliminate, first of all, your sleeve being close to the gas flame or the burner, because you're trying to aim it and pouring it over something, you know, directly on the side of the pan. It's going to eliminate things falling into the burner because it's dripping down the side. And with your spoon or the thing that you're stirring with, you know exactly where things are. That works for everything. Even if you're pouring pasta into boiling water, I would encourage you to try it. It works every time. Talking about stove and oven safety. Well, what I tell people is that the stove won't chase you around the room. You are in control of your stove and oven. However, if you're having a bad day, your head hurts, you don't feel good, the boss yelled at you, you're distracted, you had a fight, you just aren't at your best, that is not the time to be crossing busy intersections, and it's not the time to be messing around with your stove. Because the stove is something that requires your concentration. When I work with clients who demonstrate some memory issues, memory problems, we're not as likely to really encourage using the stove more than the microwave, only because we want to make sure that that person is fully aware of what they're doing. What I tell people is before you even turn on the stove, the burners, before you even start, I always approach the stove dead on straight, and I make sure that my hand is about shoulder height, and I bring it down towards the burners. Now, if I live alone, I know that no one's going to use that stove before I got to it. However, it's just a good practice. As you're approaching the stove, your hand is at shoulder height, and you bring it down slowly, and you feel all the burners to make sure that they're cool. They're not hot. And if you live with other people, that's a concern. Next thing you want to do is make sure there's nothing hot in the stove. I used to have roommates, and they would leave the iron on there to cool. Or the dish towel, you know, because the phone rang and they left, or they left the skillet on there. You want to make sure there's nothing on there before you start. Make sure your surface areas are clutter-free so that you can work freely and not have all things all over the place. Then you want to make sure that if you're starting from a cold burner, that you can actually just center your pan onto the burner. If you're starting with a hot burner, let's say you're making something and you have to remove it from the heat and bring it back onto the burner, and you can't eyeball it because the contrast isn't good, your depth perception's off, that's where you use the wooden spoon, and you can find the handle of the skillet with the spoon because you're bringing around the outside circumference of the skillet like a little tiny cane, and you can find the handle of the skillet. You grab it with your left hand, then you can slide it onto the burner, and you can then use the same wooden spoon to use it to go around the burner to make sure it's centered on the burner itself. I used to also suggest that for when you're putting a lid on and off of a pan. Again, folks who have some residual vision, their vision may not be all that reliable, and you're reaching out, and you're going to get burned. So it's just kind of a good thing to get started on. Using an implement like that to reach out to find things instead of using your bare fingers to do that as well. With the oven. Same thing. You approach it to the front, open it up, make sure it's nice and cool. Open it up, make sure everything's out of there. There's no bread in there. There's no pots and pans. There's not all kinds of things in there that people use for storage. Pull those things out. Make sure that the shelf is where you want it to be. Make sure it's secure. And then you can place your item inside the oven. Now, you can place it, a lot of things you can place into a cold oven. Any type of casserole, any type of meatloaf, anything like that, really you can just put into a cold oven. You can just turn on the heat and then just add on an extra, well, if it's a gas oven, probably an extra 3 to 5 minutes. For electric, maybe a little extra 10 minutes. That saves you a lot with messing with the heat. When you're going to move things from there, again, you can use the wooden spoon, or you can use one of those forks. You know those forks we use for big meat, like a big carving fork? You can use that to pull out the tray with that. And with your heavily mitted hand, you could pull in and pull out the item that you're looking for. One of the things I'm really concerned about when people are using the oven and the stovetop is making sure the surface area is clean and not cluttered. Whatever you don't use, put away. If you've got something on your counter that you've had there and you haven't used in a month, maybe there's a better place for it so you have more of a working area. It's very difficult to move around when you have all this stuff in the way. You know, we can be overstimulated with tactile things, and it's going to be very frustrating. Very briefly, I want to talk to you about locating strategies. How many of you, when you've gone out to eat, have knocked over your wine glass, knocked over your cup, nearly fried your hand with the moved candle that's there? This is something that can be avoided, and it's a real simple thing. Basically, what I teach, and it's called finger trailing. When you have your hand, put your hand on a flat surface, like out here, and I'm curling my fingertips under. Okay, so I'm making like a C with my hand. So my fingertips are curled under. And I make sure that my fingernails are actually touching the surface. And then I can very slowly look for things. What I do is I cut the plate in half from 12 to 6. So on the right side of my plate, I can feel with my hands. I can find my silverware. I can find my cup. I can find the salt and pepper. Then on the left side, I can use my left hand again with my fingernails, things curled under. And I can find the things on my left side. What often happens is all of us who had vision at one time, who don't now, who don't have good vision, we just react. Oh, I want that coffee. Reach out, and there it goes. Falls over. The lovely wine glass, which is top heavy as it is, if you don't hit it at the bottom, hit it toward the top, it's going to fall over. So if you're using this technique, you're basically hitting things at the base. And your fingers are curled under so that you have a natural bumper with your second knuckle. So if it's hitting things, you're hitting it at the base at a lower level, and you're not likely to knock things over. Unless, of course, you go willy-nilly. And I would encourage you not to do that, to just take your time. And what you can do is, while you're talking to your guests, you can be doing that in such a real subtle way that they don't even know you're doing it. What you want to avoid is putting your nose down to it and trying to see it. It just doesn't look good. It just doesn't look good, especially when you don't want to draw attention to yourself. So that's a real simple way of finding it. You should use that in everything. Everything from now on. at your desk, at the kitchen counter, everywhere, and you will avoid knocking things off. But we really have to teach people to slow down, because if you've had vision at one time, it's so easy just to react. You just forget you can't see, and nobody understands that. It's the most difficult thing to explain to somebody. You just don't think about it. You just don't think about it. They wanted me to touch on cleaning. Well, a couple of things. One of the most demotivating thing about cleaning is trying to find the cleanser. What is this bottle? What is this bottle? And not having things in a place where you can just easily grab it. Now, it's going to be really important, all of you who have don't have a lot of functional vision, and all of you who, to get under that kitchen cupboard and clean it out, get rid of the things you don't use, become minimalist. If you can become a minimalist by minimizing some of those things that you haven't used for years, which are chemical hazards, I'm afraid, you don't need them under there. So if you get rid of the things you don't use and just use the things that you do, then you can label them easily, or you'll just know what they are by the shape of their container. But what I also talk about is I have a bucket. And in that bucket, I have all the things I would use for the bathroom, and I have another bucket that I use for everything in the kitchen. That way, I just carry the whole bucket into the bathroom and clean. So that part is easy. But when it comes to the actual technique of cleaning, there is no mystery with that. It's called methodical consistency. Basically what that means, if you vacuum your living room at least once a week, but if you are vacuuming, let's say you're going to vacuum your living room, you're going to divide it into four sections. Now, some of this just makes a lot of sense, and there are actual textbooks on this stuff, okay? So people who get their degrees in rehab teaching, there are books that have all this stuff in it. And I would encourage you, if you get the talking books, to call them up and get a list of the books that have all these how-tos, because you'll be amazed at how many there are that are available, that are already recorded, and will teach you these things. So you don't really have to have some rehab teacher there for everything you need to do. For cleaning, again, you're going to want to break the tasks down. If you're vacuuming, divide the room in half and vacuum one half of the room, then vacuum the other half of the room. If you're going to be cleaning the sink, again, you should always clean your sink. The sink is not that big of a surface area. I usually put the amount on the sponge itself and I can feel it. I use like a soft scrub. Or you can use any type of Ajax. I mean, I'm not selling cleansers. But what I am selling is the fact that if you do it on a consistent basis, you're not likely to overlook any area in particular. You just want to make sure you have a methodical approach and that you do a systematic approach when you're doing something. Just like if you're going to polish a car. You start at one end, you go all the way to the end. You don't start at one end and then go to the next, jump over around. You usually start from one end, go all the way to the other side. So the two things with regards to cleaning is consistency, doing it regularly, and making sure that your cleansers are something that you know about, so you're not putting something horrible on your shower walls and destroying the finish. The other areas they want me to cover was on grooming. Now, this could be anywhere from how to put on makeup, to where you get your hair done, to shaving. This area, gosh, it's so huge. What I am surprised about is the number of men who say they can't shave, that they can't see themselves in the mirror. And shaving is a real tactile experience. If you're using an electric razor, it's not that difficult to feel with the left hand and shave with the right hand. The same thing with a regular razor. You want to make sure that the razor's good. Now, the area that men have more concern about are the sideburns and making sure that they're even. When you're looking at your face and you're looking at where your ears are, most people have ears that are even, and if you can find the spot inside the hole of your ear and then go across towards the front of your face, you can have a consistent, at least your sideburns are even. So if you want to do it a little bit higher, a little bit lower, but make sure they're measured to something, again, that's not going to move, and that's going to be your ear. If you measure based on, like, the one little flap in front of your ear, that's a guideline by which to to shave for the sideburns. For women in makeup, eyeliner is a real challenge. It really is. Because you don't want the liquid stuff out. Forget the liquid stuff. There is just no way that liquid stuff you're going to use. The eye pencils are fine, yet keep them sharp. They really have to be sharpened. Clinique has a really good eye pencil that I like. One side is the actual pencil. The other side, though, is like a powdered pencil. So it gives them a softer shading under the eye for the eyeliner. Something else that can be done, and depends on where you live, you can have your eyelashes dyed, tinted. It's not very expensive, and it lasts for about 2 months. So there goes, you don't have to worry about the mascara. Depending on your eye condition, it's not always advisable for different eye conditions. But that's something else. Having your eyebrows waxed, that's something that's not that expensive either. Again, it's something you don't have to worry about because it's almost impossible to do that when you can't see it very clearly. And then again, a combination of magnifying mirror and good lighting, you might be able to do it. You might be able to do it. With makeup, it's very important. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. The color is really important. If you get a foundation that doesn't match your skin tone, don't care how well you see, it's going to look terrible. So it's important you get good makeup and go with somebody who knows what they're doing. And also recognize that foundation, the liquid foundation, changes color. So when you're in the store and you have it on, put it on for about an hour and then come back. Because it'll change color on your skin. When you apply it, it's easier to apply it if you've already had your face has moisturizer on it, so you don't need as much. I don't like... Oftentimes with those bottles, they have the wide bottles, the open mouth, neck, and people, they shake it and they put it on their finger. You're likely to get the foundation all over the place. It's much easier to shake it with the lid on and then take what's in the lid and apply it. Or stick your finger inside the bottle itself versus trying to pour it onto your finger by shaking it with your finger over the top, if you know what I'm talking about. With blush, liquid blush is miserable. You're much better off with a powder, and you're much better off, too, if you have good tools, like a nice brush, and you're with a friend who gets good feedback. I call them talking mirrors, and the only reason you only need them for a couple of times, towards the beginning when you first use it, because sometimes with the brush, depending on how dark it is, with the brush, if you go across one, two, three, and you tap it on the side, and you apply it, make sure you do one, two, three, tap it, and apply it on the other side as well, so that you're even. But what you're going to need your friend is the first time you apply it, make sure that you don't need to do it three times if you just need to do it two times. Also, towards the end, when it's running low, you know, it gets caked up, you may be going one, two, three, applying it, and not getting anything. So that's when, again, you need to have somebody, and I do that, I go into the office, does this look okay? You know, and they'll say, you know. But if you don't ask, people won't tell you. How many of you are worried about spots on your clothes? The rule of thumb, if it's white, once. You wear it once, and it goes into the laundry. You never know what you bumped against. You never know what you dribbled. You just never know. And better to be safe than to be sorry. Sometimes I carry a supply of little safety pins, so if I get a spot, and I'll ask somebody where it is, I'll just put a little safety pin on the underside, so that when I go home, I can put some spray and wash on it. So I'll make sure that that's taken care of. So in terms of your clothing, making sure they look nice, it's important to have somebody that you trust. When you're shopping for clothes, I tend to go to smaller shops. They tend to be a little more expensive. But you can also go to a department store, get to know the clerk real well, have her be your buddy. What's your name? Oh, my name's Anita. What's your name? Oh, great. Can you help me out? What's on sale? Usually, they love to spend your money. It's a lot of fun. I love to go shopping alone. I get better deals than if I go with somebody I know, only because they know the merchandise. Same with guys, when men go shopping, it's probably not going to be wise to go to Kmart, because there's nobody there to help you. You're not going to go to Target or Kmart or Walmart. You're going to have to go to a Penny's or some of the other department stores where they have people there who know what they're doing to get some assistance. Now, when it comes to labeling clothes, So there's this wonderful thing called the barcode identifier, and you can actually attach these barcodes to your clothing that goes through the laundry. And what you can do is you can record something on the barcode, and when you bring this little wand up to it, it tells you exactly what it is. You can use it for clothing, for paper, for everything, food. Only $1,500, but it's a wonderful device. Hopefully it'll go down in price. So it's also the color identifier. It'll identify clothing colors. So these are the things you do with everything and have all the toys and gadgets, which I don't have. I'd love to have it, but, you know. But there are other ways to label clothing. A lot of men like to put little French knots in their shirts. You know, one French knot in the tie might indicate something, two French knots mean something else. Or one French knot in a label might indicate white, two might label blue, three might label stripes. Safety pins. I have these things called matchmakers. And again, the idea is you have this little safety pin and a little tactile marking on it. So you assign a meaning to the marking. So let's use the alphabet. All of my black things I don't label. All of my blue things I put one, I think it was one dot. All of my things that are brown I put two dots. All the things that are gray may have three dots. That way it's easy to remember it because the alphabet, again, is consistent. You can assign a meaning to it, and you know by the order of things. Safety pins. Safety pins in certain spots will tell you something. If you put a safety pin that's parallel to the hem, that might tell you that it's blue, the color of the sky. If you get it so the safety pin is facing down towards the hem along the seam, that might tell you that it's brown because the color of the dirt. But depending on how you want to label things, how you want to assign some meaning to it, you can use Braille. There's a real simple way of labeling clothes. They have those lovely Braille tags, which I hate. I really do hate those because they're limited. You can buy these things called freezer labels. You can use those to label meat, label, you know, freezer. They're usually devised, they're designed for freezer items. But I use them for clothing. So that way I can put a whole dialogue onto the label. Because most of my things aren't solid colors. You can also use, for those who have some vision, you can, you know, attach it with a card. You know, a card that's written nice and big so you can label your item with that and put a safe clothespin on it. Doesn't work if you're using laundry, though. So that's not the most ideal way of doing it. But, you know, I've covered a lot of areas. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Anita Arakawa, for inspiring us to continue finding new ways to meet those challenges that are imposed by low vision in our daily lives, no matter what level of vision we have or don't have. Hopefully, this session will encourage all of us to remember that we might have low vision, but low vision doesn't have us. Everybody take good care of yourselves and each other. We'll see you all in May.